two novels reveal the devastating impact of war on families and those families' resilience in the face of tragedy. First, The Blue Between Sky and Water by Susan Abulhawa.
For Palestinians, time in a lot of ways has become almost circular or at least frozen in some ways. The generation that was exiled in 1948 never really left 1948. You know, they lived in these refugee camps, dreaming and imagining going home and holding on to their deeds and their keys and their life goal and their purpose. Their whole purpose in life was to return to their homes. And they kind of passed that longing onto the subsequent generations.
Then we talk with Jacqueline Sheehan about her novel, The Center of the World.
And I sort of emerged at Lake Atitlan in Guatemala and learned about these Mayan people. They had been really brutalized by the military for a very long time, and yet they are the most enduring people I have ever met.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. What happens when a people are expelled from their homeland, from their homes where their families tilled the land for centuries, where their ancestors are buried, where they had hoped to build bright futures for their children? How do they retain their humanity in the face of such injustice? And how do they knit their lives and their families back together in spite of it? All these questions come vividly alive in Susan Abulhawa's new novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. It's a powerful story about one Palestinian family that follows them from their idyllic village life in pre-Israel Palestine, expulsion in 1947, and through exile in Gaza and the U.S. Through it all runs the indomitable spirit of women, from the matriarch in Gaza, who holds the family together in the face of brutal occupation, to a young niece who returns to Palestine looking for her real home after a childhood spent in foster care in the U.S. Author Susan Abulhawa's first novel was the best-selling Mornings in Jenin. Now, in The Blue Between Sky and Water, she immerses the reader in the rich lives of the characters in a way that forever shreds the ugly stereotypes of Palestinians and Muslim women so current in the West. In addition to her writing, Susan Abulhawa also works with Playgrounds for Palestine, an organization she founded. Her parents were refugees of the 1967 war. Susan Abulhawa, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is just one of the most powerful novels that I've read in a long time, and I've read some really great ones. The Blue Between Sky and Water, this one was so powerful, not only the way it was written, but because of its subject. It's a story about the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in what became the State of Israel, and their lives under Israeli occupation. The story also takes place in the Gaza part of those occupied territories. But it's also the story of a family, and one particular family. Let's start with the family itself, just to introduce the characters. I think a lot of people think that Muslim women have no power, but the women in this story are its heart and soul. So tell us about them.
There are several women of different generations in the same family who dominate this narrative. The principal ones are Nazmiye. She's a matriarch in the family. She's kind of she's a wisecracker, manipulative, foul-mouthed, maternal, loving, sort of uninhibited in a lot of ways, and her word is the last word in the family in every way. And the other main character is Nur. She is Nazmiya's grand-niece, and Nur grows up in the U.S. She's the woman in the family who kind of gets lost away her grandfather travels to the United States, and he passes away before they're able to return to Gaza, and she ends up growing up in foster care. So Noor, even though she, and this is explicitly stated in the story sometimes, she kind of grows up with everything that they want in Gaza, with opportunity, freedom to move about, to go anywhere in the world with this magical American passport, clean water, plenty of food, education, opportunity, etc. But somehow Noor is kind of the most broken one among them in a lot of ways. Having grown up without family and sort of institutional care was an experience that kind of burrowed holes in her. And another character is Alwan. Alwan is Nosmia's daughter, who you can imagine kind of growing up with such a forceful mother and with such a big presence. Alwan is a little bit more in the shadows. She's more reserved. But her waters run really deep, and she's a complicated character. She's pious and religious, but also a thinker too, and she questions a lot of the assumptions that were kind of handed down to her from by society. And her daughter Rachel is the youngest of these women, and she's sort of the face of hope, or just kind of the future rather, and the person that they're all kind of investing themselves into in a way. And there is one primary male character, Rachel's brother, Khaled, and he is he's kind of the thread that binds everyone and binds previous generations and future generations, and his voice is kind of it's an ethereal kind of otherworldly voice. Because although he is flesh and blood, at least for a part of the narrative, Khaled goes into a kind of coma-like state called locked-in syndrome, and where he can perceive the world around him, but he cannot respond or interact with the world. So in other words, he can see, hear, feel, smell, everything, but he can't respond except by blinking his eyes or moving his diaphragm to breathe. And so in that sort of prison of his own body, Khaled finds his own freedom. He retreats into himself, and he's able to then transcend time, to transcend the physical world that those around him are bound by. So those are the characters. And it's interesting that you sort of brought up this stereotype of Muslim women. I did a couple of book tours recently for translations of the novel, and one of the comments that I got rather consistently, and so more than twice, was how surprised people were that the women, not only did they, sort of defy images or stereotypes of the passive, sort of subservient, quiet Muslim woman. But there is a surprise that the women could be so different from one another. And that was really, to me, that was more telling than anything about, how the world sees us as Muslim women as being sort of almost uniform. Necessarily similar. I don't think it would occur to anyone that, if the characters had all been white and Western, that, wow, they're so different from each other. How can that be? But and the fact that it was such an immediate response or impression by some Western readers from this novel really kind of speaks to what the general perception is of Muslim Arab women and how we are supposed to be in the world.
Well, what do you attribute that to?
Well, there aren't, the West really isn't exposed to a lot of to Muslim women very much. It's not like they, you know, there are any television shows that show Muslim women, ordinary Muslim women, in any kind of, you know, any life situations, except as kind of victims of you know, crazy of a crazy world, and or as passive. I mean, these are all, you know, the image that people have is the image that's perpetuated in popular culture, whether it be film, news media, or newspapers, broadcast media. If you think about what people in this country see, I mean, that's the stereotype. It's really not just for women, but also for men. I mean, when was the last time you saw a film with a loving Arab Muslim father in it, or you know, a comedian, an Arab comedian, or, you know, people aren't interested in our lives in that way, except as we are relevant politically, or how we fit into sort of American foreign policy or something.
Yeah, especially at this time when the images of Muslims are, you know, such images that inspire hatred and are meant to inspire hatred. Those are the images that are being put out there. But let's go back to this wonderful book, because one of the things that I think it did is that it really does open this culture and the richness of Palestinian culture to the reader, and does so within the context of exile, really. You know, exile either into under occupation or even further on, as what happens with Noor. So let's go back to the beginning. It starts in 1948 in the village of Beit Daras. Is this a real village, by the way?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about that and, you know, what the life of the people are like there just in the moments before the Israeli, you know, the Israeli army comes in and expels them quite brutally.
Well, Beit Daras, like most Palestinian villages were, especially rural ones, were mostly agricultural communities. Beit Daras had a beekeeping industry, hives. So yeah, the main industries in Beit Daras were agriculture and beekeeping. And the, you know, the bit in there about the schools and when they were built and so forth, the classrooms and the collections to pay the teachers, that's actually real. I got that information from a dear friend of mine who wrote a book about Beit Daras. He's from Beit Daras. His name is Ramzi Baroud, and the book is called My Father Was a Freedom Fighter. So I was able to get a lot of information about Beit Daras. There's quite a history around it. And it was like all other towns. I mean, people were, they were busy with their lives. You know, it was a community, like many other communities in Palestine, that had lived under various rules under the Ottomans and then the British and many others before them for thousands of years. But it was really only the new Israeli conquest by principally European Jews that had settled in Palestine. It was that was the first conquest and occupation that really sought to eliminate Palestinians and remove them from their ancestral lands and replace them. So you can imagine it was the whole village was traumatized, and then this particular village was mostly pushed into Gaza, and a lot of the residents of Beit Daras ended up in refugee camps there.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Susan Abulhawa about her terrific new novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. So now they go to Gaza, and on the way, I mean, during this whole terrible expulsion, there is an incredible incident with a, I don't even know how to pronounce it, djinn? Is that?
That's right, it's djinn.
Djinn. Okay, so
yeah, that's where the word genie comes from.
Right, and there are some pretty strong elements of magical realism in the story. I mean, you've already referred to Khaled, who does make an appearance in the beginning of the story in 1948, even though he's really not born until decades later. So talk a little bit about why, well, first tell us what a djinn is and what he does. What is this kind of appearance in the book and in the culture? And then why did you use these elements of magical realism in The Blue Between Sky and Water?
It's interesting that you're calling it magical realism, and others have done so too. But I actually didn't at any point set out to... I mean, there was never any point where I said, oh, I'm going to have elements of magical realism in here. And in fact, I didn't even think of it as such until you know, people started reviewing it. A djinn is, that's where the word genie comes from. It's they are otherworldly creatures, magical creatures, that most Muslims, especially Muslims in rural areas, believe in, because they are mentioned in the Quran, and the Quran sort of validates their presence in the world. So when I was growing up, my grandmother really believed in djinn, and so it was part of my childhood, at least. And you know, like when I was naughty or something, or if she was mad at me, she would, you know, say something like "Jinn irkabek," or which means "May a djinn possess you." and I was kind of terrified, you know, being possessed by a djinn. And then I, you know, as I sort of got a little bit older, I was thinking, oh, how cool it would be to have a djinn friend, and they could just make all my wishes come true, and it would be a good djinn. I mean, so these were, you know, it was just part of my childhood, and I had really strong memories of those thoughts and ruminations that went through my young, innocent mind. So it was, it felt natural and organic to have a character who was able to communicate with the djinn. And it's actually Nazmiya's mother. She was considered the village, you know, crazy woman. And so, you know, the djinn's name is Suleiman, and he mostly is in the beginning of the story, although he makes a couple of minor appearances here and there in other parts. But, you know, this element of the book is in many ways tangential. So it's, yeah, but it was an element that felt... it felt right. I don't really ever plan a novel. I don't plan the stories. I don't really know what's going to happen. I start with an idea or a seed, and then I kind of write for a long time, almost stream of consciousness, and then when I have a big, when I have volume, in other words, when I have lots of pages, I just kind of go back and start molding and rewriting and thinking about characters and getting to know them and just, you know, kind of letting their stories unfold organically. And that, you know, the djinn being in there was made perfect sense to me.
And he may be tangential, but Khalid is not. And
no.
He also, I mean, he goes back in time to teach Nazmiya's mother how to read. Nazmiya's sister how to read, that's right. Maryam, yes.
Mm-hmm.
She with the one brown eye and the one blue eye, as Noor also has. So, I mean, these are elements that I guess as a reader I had to see as symbolic of the larger story. Is they just came out of your stream of consciousness, or is there something that you're saying of a more, you know, metaphorical meaning of this idea that time, the idea of time in the novel?
So the idea of time not being linear, or at least being perverted in some way, was also present in my previous novel, although perhaps, you know, not so obviously. And, you know, it's one of the things that I really like it when readers think about it and sort of explore on their own. For Palestinians, time in a lot of ways has become almost circular or at least frozen in some ways. The generation that was exiled in 1948 never really left 1948. And, you know, they lived in these refugee camps. dreaming and imagining going home and holding on to their deeds and their keys and their life goal and their purpose. Their whole purpose in life was to return to their homes. And they kind of passed that longing onto the subsequent generations. And so there's a whole portion of Palestinian society that, in a lot of ways, hasn't been able to leave 1948. And there are actually concrete and political reasons for that, not just spiritual or emotional, psychological reasons. And likewise, you know, the same thing happened to those who were exiled in 1967. So there is kind of this, you know, when history is not redeemed for people, and, you know, you kind of end up living in this collective wound, whether you want to or not, because it becomes part of your identity in a way. So that's, you know, I suppose that's something, you know, readers can consider when it comes to the elements of time in this novel. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, Khaled being magical realism or not, his, you know, his condition, what he does, I mean, I did leave it open for readers to consider that there were perhaps more conventional explanations for what was happening to him. You know, at one point, someone describes his condition, or his grandmother's condition, rather. Sorry, great-grandmother's condition as being schizophrenia. And, you know, being locked in one's body and one's mind can create all kinds of thoughts and that aren't real and so forth. So there, you know, for the logically minded among us, you know, it's open to that kind of interpretation. But it's also open to other interpretations that, you know, that actually this was real, that he did travel in time and all this really did happen exactly as it says it happened. So, you know, what's real is probably not the point.
Right. I want to go back to what you said about time in this, though. There's a really telling moment in the book where you write about the bombing of Gaza, and you write that Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. It's a powerful passage to read. Tell us, well, I mean, Israel has bombed Gaza quite a number of times, but I'm thinking this might have been, what, 2009? No, I'm not sure when was that one. But just that
2008, 2009. It was December 2008 into January 2009.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So you write that Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, people, you know, living amidst this incredible destruction should have put you in this immense kind of pause. Life has paused. The earth isn't spinning anymore. The sun is kind of stuck in the sky, and it's just beating down on you, and you know, there's nowhere to go, no, you know, what do you do except try and salvage? And I think these kinds of situations are so profound and so heavy and so dense and so laden with things that are incomprehensible to those of us who don't live these moments that, yeah, it's powerful enough to make day into night and night into day and just stop the earth spin as far as you're concerned.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with Susan Abulhawa about her novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. So our listeners know a little bit, I found the passage. I'm going to read a little bit from it, if it's okay with you, just the first paragraph of that chapter. Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. As if time had been wounded, it now moved in a crawl, its daily passage impeded by the rubble that carpeted the terrain, its presence so thick that Haja Nazmiya felt the sun dragging along the heavy weight of each hour. So much needed to be done, yet there was nothing to do. People gathered with nothing to say. Even when they spoke, their words were coated in a silence that stared into a chasm as they picked out and buried their dead. Even rage and calls for revenge seemed perfunctory. Tears made for a sort of refuge. a place to go to feel something in a wreckage that demanded numbness. For many, it was simply a waiting to die. Hope seemed vulgar in this hour, and the idea of death was so comforting and alluring that no one spoke, lest words do away with the seduction of a quiet ending. And I wanted to read that because, first of all, the language is beautiful, but I think it's in evoking the real experience of people that you can really move hearts. I have never really been inside, you know, what happened in this way that you express. And tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, your own experience. You're the founder of an organization, Playgrounds for Palestine. I assume you've been to Palestine, is it right?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your own experience of this kind of situation and how that...
I've never lived through bombing.
But you lived
in Palestine when I was younger. I lived in an orphanage in Jerusalem. And I've been back many times each year. Until last summer when I was not allowed in, but I've not lived through bombing campaigns. I've witnessed the aftermath, but I was never a victim of that.
You lived in an orphanage in Jerusalem?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say something about how you got there?
Not really.
The reason I ask is because Noor, I had a sense that there was a backstory to Noor that reflected some of your own.
The part about Noor living in foster care in the U.S. Is real. I did live in foster care in the United States. But prior to that, I lived in an orphanage in Jerusalem. And that experience actually was, I put the lead character in my first novel, Mornings in Jenin, in my life in that orphanage for 3 years. So I did kind of talk about it in the novel, but I'm really not all that interested in talking about how I got there. It doesn't really matter.
Okay. But then the foster care, this is another very strong element in this story, which is the story of Noor, who's not only exiled from her family in Gaza, in Palestine, but she is also exiled from her own family. Her grandfather, who she loves, dies when she's quite young. Her mother is a flaming narcissist who, you know, is terribly rejecting. So tell us a little bit about this theme. I mean, it seemed to me it was very relevant to the larger political theme, but it's also a very striking human story in itself.
Noor does, like I said, she ends up in the United States alone, and she's forced to go into to foster care. She becomes a ward of the state, and she, you know, she grows up in kind of a very empty adequacy, I guess. You know, foster care was adequate. That's how it was for me. You know, got enough food, enough good shelter, etc. I never experienced any of the horror stories that one hears about foster care. But it was, it was nothing anyone would ever describe as home. It was in existence, and it was adequate. And that's what Noor experienced, and that was sort of the basis of her longing to go to Gaza.
Well, is there anything else you would like to say about the book? You know, what was the most... you know, the greatest challenge for you in writing this, and what would you most like a reader to take away from it?
I don't have expectations of readers. In fact, I'm more interested in hearing what they do take away of their own accord, not influenced by me necessarily. And it is that actually is very interesting to me because sometimes I've been surprised by what readers see and what they find. And also, I have to say, too, that when I'm writing, I don't ever think about the reader or how they're going to react or what they're going to take from anything. I don't think about the publisher either. I don't even think about the politics or what my community is going to think of me or et cetera for having, certain elements in there that might be frowned upon, etc. My only loyalty really is to the characters. I work really hard to get to know them and to love them, to feel something towards them, even if it's a negative feeling. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I hate to break in, but you say you don't care about the politics, but the politics is a very crucial part of this story, and there is a lot that you write in this story that is
Important to me to get the politics right.
Not
the politics so much, but the history and the reality.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that's what I mean. And the way you present the Israeli occupation is, you know, the way I think my ancestors in Europe would talk about the Nazi incursions into their communities. I mean, it's very strong language, and it's powerful language, and it made me really think a lot of things through. You know, I mean,
well, and because that's what the characters are thinking. And again, that kind of goes to my loyalty to the characters and to their lives and to their realities and how they see the world and you know what they're surrounded by. So, I mean, you know, maybe it sounds like you're having a hard time sort of accepting that, but that's the reality. No, I'm not.
But I'm thinking that in this time, when mm-hmm. when the politics is so raw, where Islamophobia is, you know, just exploded all around us, where, you know, the struggle of the Palestinians, I mean, I think, you know, in the U.S., certainly, maybe in the rest of the world, people are beginning to understand more the injustice of the Israeli occupation, but here at home, they don't. So that's why I guess I feel like a book like this, you know, the politics, yes, it's not just the reality of the characters, but it's also telling the reader what it's like.
You know, you say that because you're a Western reader, but maybe, you know, Palestinian readers read this too, and they're very much aware of the situation. So again, readers, there's all kinds of readers, and they read things for different reasons, and they react differently, and they see things differently, and that's my point.
Fair enough. Susan Abulhawa, you're a wonderful novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. I recommend it to all our listeners. It's a wonderful read, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca.
In addition to The Blue Between Sky and Water, Susan Abulhawa is the author of Mornings in Jenin and the founder of the organization Playgrounds for Palestine. Next up, we talk with Jacqueline Sheehan about her new novel, The Center of the World. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The civil war in Guatemala raged for more than 30 years and killed an estimated 200,000 people. 83% of them were Mayan, mostly desperately poor villagers in the highlands. 200,000 is a statistic, but behind that number are the real people who suffered, died, or saw their families ripped apart by the violence. Now, best-selling author Jacqueline Sheehan brings that reality to life in her new novel, The Center of the World. It tells the story of Kate Mallory, a young American scientist who rescues a Mayan baby from a massacre in which her mother has just been murdered. Kate brings the child to the U.S. and raises her as her adopted daughter, Sophia. But seeking to shield Sophia from traumatic memories, she tells her a lie about her origins. 12 years later, that lie is blown apart by a stunning revelation, and the novel's young co-protagonist, Sophia, embarks on a perilous journey to discover her hidden history. In the course of that journey, mother and daughter must find a way to confront the truth about each other and themselves, and rebuild their relationship on a new foundation. In addition to The Center of the World, Jacqueline Sheehan is the author of 4 previous novels. 3 are part of a mystery series about a sleuth and her dog, Cooper, and the first is a historical novel about Sojourner Truth. You can go to writersvoice.net to hear our interviews with Sheehan about those books. You know, aside from your first novel about Sojourner Truth, A Comet's Tale, this is really the first one in a long time that isn't a mystery story with a dog at its center.
It's true.
And it centers around a tragic time in the history of Guatemala, the civil war that ran from 1960 to 1996, and what's been called the genocide of the Mayan people. Jacqueline Sheehan, why did you decide to write The Center of the World about this time?
You know, I started traveling to Guatemala in 2006, and it was a pretty pivotal time for me. I had just I just lost my mother. I had just been a mental health specialist to Hurricane Katrina victims with the Red Cross. It's sort of a compounding of losses and traumas, and I sort of emerged at Lake Atitlan in Guatemala and learned about these Mayan people. And there's no way that you can romanticize the Mayans. I mean, I suppose you could, but they had been really brutalized by the military for a very long time, as you said, and yet they are the most enduring people I have ever met. You know, and the scars from the genocide were still there, you know, and the crushing poverty, alcoholism had swept through, there was domestic abuse, and yet I could tell that these people were going to survive, and they were going to do it with fairly good humor, and that they had a lot to teach us. And then I began to imagine, well, what would it have been like to be on the scene, say in 1990, a bit toward the tail end of their atrocities. But, you know, to be a sort of a scientist and a researcher and appear on the scene and be dropped into this setting. And the book is based on one of the massacres. I had many, many to pick from, but one in particular that did happen on Lake Atitlan. Most of the massacres of the Mayan villages happened in the highlands of northern Guatemala. But I began to imagine, what would it be like to be a North American, know nothing of what was happening in Central America, and get dropped into the middle of this? What would you do?
And you are, of course, referring to one of your 2 protagonists. That is Kate Malloy, water scientist Kate Malloy, who comes to Guatemala in 1990 to do research on water quality. Tell us about her, and then we'll talk more about the other protagonist, her adopted daughter, Sophia.
Kate is a doctoral student studying water, you know, which is will be one of the most studied things on our planet soon. But what is motivating Kate in many ways is that when she was 15, her mother died of cancer very quickly. And it sort of knocked her legs out from under her. And it's sort of what is chasing her here and there. And it is something that she will ultimately have in common with this young Mayan girl. Will be the loss of mother.
And so now to Sophia. as the book opens, you actually open it when Sophia is, I guess, around 14 years old. And she's living with her mother in Western Massachusetts. Her stepfather, Martin, has just died in a terrible accident. And he left a message for his daughter. What's that message?
So Martin reaches out from the grave, so to speak, to leave this message for his stepdaughter, Sophia, the adopted daughter, Kate's adopted daughter. And the message is, Sophia has believed all of this time that she's always known she was adopted, but she believes she was adopted from Mexico, and Kate brought her up to Massachusetts, and she has lived fairly contentedly ever since. The message is, Sophia, you are not from Mexico. You are from Guatemala. You were illegally brought into the country. Your documents of adoption may not be legal, and your mother operated at great risk to bring you here, but she made me promise never to tell you this for reasons that she will have to disclose to you. So that is how the book opens, sort of this shocking affront to Sophia, who's a young high school sophomore soccer star, young woman.
Yeah, and she reacts pretty badly to this message. Why?
I think she reacts so badly because there is a part of Sophia, as we learn later, who's had this inkling, you know, this little filament that pulls her to Guatemala, pulls her to this feeling that, you know, there is something else, there is someone else. You really do have people elsewhere. And it is very shocking also for her to learn that her mother has lied to her, that there's this huge sense of betrayal, that her mother would lie about this very essential thing, really, Sophia's genesis. Where do you come from? Who are you?
Tell us how Kate did adopt Sophia, or at least how Sophia came into Kate's life.
So in the book, there is a massacre in the village square of a particular group of Mayans who are there to protest the jailing of several of their village men. And this is sort of unheard of at that time, that they would protest in this way. But they did. And I think that the military were taken sort of aback by this. They were quite shocked that the village people would rise up and sort of, you know, make a demand of them and say, you know, you have unjustly jailed these two individuals and we want them out. And for whatever reason, something goes very, very wrong and there's a massacre. And it just so happens that Kate Malloy is present. She's a witness to this horrible massacre, and she scoops up the one surviving person from this massacre, and it happens to be this little tiny Mayan girl who's only 2 years old, and she realizes that she is a witness. Essentially, the little child is a witness, and that she has got to get her out of there, and that is what she does.
Now, she had known this child beforehand because she knew the mother, Manuela, and I was very moved by the relationship between Kate Malloy and Manuela. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you negotiated, you know, the cultural differences?
The cultural differences, you know, for those of us who do travel, the cultural differences are a 24-hour thing that you have to negotiate. And I would have to say that in most places that I've been, people on both, you know, the indigenous people and people who are visiting and traveling, everyone is doing it. Everyone is struggling with this kind of negotiation. With Manuela and Kate, they become friends. Kate is teaching Manuela English to increase Manuela's viability to be able to sell her weavings. There are three languages that they must negotiate. There is English, there is Spanish, and there is Quechacal, which is the native Mayan language that Manuela speaks. So Manuela's first language is not Spanish. Kate's first language is not Spanish. So they're sort of on equal rocky ground with Spanish, and then they're trying to learn English. But they struggle through it, and they become friends. They're trying very hard to become friends.
Now, after the massacre, Kate takes Sophia, and one of the things she struggles with is that she knows, because she has known something about this culture and she has become friends with Manuela, she knows how key it is, that sense of place, the sense of homeland, the place where the ancestors are. Talk a little bit about Mayan culture and how that entered into how you wrote this aspect of the book.
One of the things I learned about the Mayan culture, and I feel so much better for it as a human being, really, is their emphasis on ancestors. Usually every year when I go down to Guatemala, I meet with some of the local shamans. And one of the first meetings I had with the shamans was the shaman's encouragement to a reminder for me to light a candle at my father's grave. And I said, what? And he said, well, don't you do that all the time? He said, "You, of course you visit your father's grave, don't you, and light a candle and have ceremony and sit and visit with him. And I said, no. This shaman was so appalled. He was so totally appalled. And then he realized that for most North Americans, we don't acknowledge our ancestors. And he said, if you do not acknowledge your ancestors, they will take a bite out of your soul, mm-hmm. which is a line that I used in the book. So there is that sense of ancestral presence that is every day with the Mayan people, every single day, every holiday, every important moment in someone's life, there is the presence of ancestors and a gratefulness to the ancestors for this life that people are experiencing. And Kate becomes, as she develops throughout this book, she is more and more keenly aware of this. And she struggles with the realization that she will be ripping this child, if she takes her away from the culture entirely, she will be ripping her away from something very, very essential. And yet the consequences, if she does not, in the midst of this war zone, are catastrophic.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with novelist Jacqueline Sheehan about her new book, The Center of the World. It's about an adopted daughter born during Guatemala's brutal civil war, and what happens when she finds out about her true origin. Talk a little bit more about this concept of the ancestors taking a bite out of your soul. I mean, it sounds like it's, you know, in vengeance, but I think it really gets to a very human truth.
I think it does, too. So taking a bite out of your soul, I kind of connect that with someone nipping at your heels, that phrase, to remind you of something, that, you know, you're not here as a solo event, that there are ancestors upon ancestors who have made this life possible for us, and that the act of acknowledging that is very, very rich and humbling, you know, that we have this moment of viability for our lifetime, and then we become ancestors. And there's a sort of continuation, a spiraling continuation that I believe the Mayans live with every day, that we can forget here that in fact is the truth.
And when I hear you say that, I think of how we really take a bite out of our own soul when we don't act in awareness of the generations that will succeed us.
Wow, that is really true, isn't it? That is so true. And the climate change talks are going on as we speak at this very moment. And who will pay the consequences for our actions in this moment but our children and our grandchildren and the children that follow?
Yeah, exactly. So this whole, in this book, Jacqueline Sheehan, in your new novel, The Center of the World, these kinds of relationships, the whole idea of relationship between family members, between friends, between those we are responsible for, is very much at the heart of this, isn't it?
It is at the heart of this. And in the title, The Center of the World, that is how the Mayans in that region refer to Lake Atitlan, which is just a massive lake, unbelievably deep, sort of almost incomprehensible lake. They call it the center of the world or the belly button of the world. And the other center of the world really is relationships, the everyday moment-to-moment relationship that we have with every single person we encounter. You know, that really is the center of the world as well.
Now, talking about relationships, I mean, the book's action moves between 1990 and then 12 years later. Going back to 1990, Kate meets a young man, an idealistic Peace Corps worker. This also is a story within the story very much about relationships and the contamination of relationships. Talk about him as much as you can. Tell us about him and the position that he is put in.
Yeah, Will is really one of my favorite characters. And I really appreciate hearing from people when they tell me that I write good men, which I enjoy doing very much. I enjoy understanding my male characters. And Will is an idealistic person. My daughter was in the Peace Corps, and my son-in-law was in the Peace Corps. One of my sisters was in the Peace Corps. So I have an understanding of what draws people into the Peace Corps. And then sometimes the great realities that burst their bubble once they are in the Peace Corps. And that is what happened with Will. Will's definitely taken advantage of by forces that he really can't quite grapple with because of his linguistic, his very unusual linguistic ability. He's able to learn languages very, very quickly. So it is his great gift that is taken advantage of and abused. And it is sort of after the trauma of that abuse that he eventually encounters Kate Malloy.
What was the role of the U.S. government in the massacres and the civil war in Guatemala? In brief.
In brief, yeah. It's the in brief part that's hard. So the U.S. really meddled in uninformed sort of ways in Central America, really without the American people knowing about it. The CIA had a presence in Central America since the early 50s, and it was, I think, two things: to protect American industrial interests, mainly United Fruit, and, you know, the whole craze about keeping communists out of Central America for fear that they would just come, you know, dashing through the Mexican borders into the United States, I suppose. We were tumbling governments left and right. We tumbled a democratically elected government in Guatemala in the early 50s, and we were supplying arms. So our role was disruption, and then I think after we abandoned our role in Guatemala to the great extent, you know, they were left with a militaristic government that has never really righted itself, and a crippled country, really.
Yeah.
I'm a bit like Kate Malloy. I'm not the most political person in the world.
But you've actually written a book that covers a lot of a lot of political issues, and they do center around, I think if I had to say one theme, it was about relationship, respectful relationships and not. Am I wrong?
I hope you're not wrong. I try to let Kate speak for those of us who are not the most informed about international politics, because so few of us are. And yet when we go to another country, that's what we experience. Mm-hmm. We experience the day-to-day trickled-down effects of what is happening politically in a country, such as a massacre.
Right. And this is really a terrific book. We've barely touched the surface, actually. It talks about adoptions, the scenes having to do with Kate's escape from the site of the massacre with Sophia are just really stunning. You said up in the beginning that, you know, this was, you know, this kind of broke the mold for you. What were some of the biggest challenges for you in writing this book?
I think that one of the biggest challenges was wanting to, this is always the case with writing a book, it's wanting to get it right. You know, when with any writer or artist, you have this picture of how it should be, but it's the getting it there that is always the hardest part. And then with the publishing world, you know, writers have been told quite a bit that American readers will not respond to a book that is set in another country, which I'm choosing not to believe that that is true. But again and again, writers are told that. We're told that by agents, not my agent, but other agents, and publishers. Oh, no, please don't set this book in another country. So there is, you know, there is that fear of, oh, my gosh, are they right? Is America that xenophobic that if the book is partially set in another country, we won't read it? I think that was one of the hesitancies that I did have.
I don't think that encumbered the book by any means, quite the opposite. And it's really a terrific read. The Center of the World, Jacqueline Sheehan, thank you so much for sending me this book to read and to give me the opportunity to interview about it for our listeners.
Oh, you are so welcome, Francesca. I always love working with you.
Thank you. Jacqueline Sheehan's book is The Center of the World. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Sheehan is also the author of four previous novels, of which three are part of a mystery series about a sleuth and her dog, Cooper. You can find a link to an interview with Sheehan and her dog, Cooper, at writersvoice.net. You can also hear some of our other interviews with Sheehan about her previous books. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.